exoplanets, Jupiter's shrinking giant red spot, and the search for extraterrestrial life. Few things fascinate us, educate us, or fire our imaginations quite the way gazing into the night sky does. The success of the reimagined TV show Cosmos starring Neil deGrasse Tyson has renewed interest in space exploration and the science of astronomy. I'm Erwin Gratz, and today on Main Calling, we'll discuss the latest news from the world of NASA, SETI, and the ISS, and we'll try to keep our acronyms to a minimum. But just so you know, NASA is the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And the ISS is the International Space Station. The countdown has begun as Main Calling gets ready for liftoff. But first, this news update. And from the MPBN studios, I'm Erwin Gratz. This is Main Calling. Well, it sounds like something out of Game of Thrones, a quest of epic proportions, a fierce storm that engulfs a landmass as big as a planet, tensions between rival powers that could end a decades-old scientific experiment, and dwarfs, galaxies, that is. As you may have guessed, what we're talking about today are matters very real and very much outside of our own orbit. We're going to talk about this ongoing search for life outside our planet, why the giant red spot on Jupiter may be shrinking, how the crisis in Ukraine could lead to trouble for the U.S. getting to the International Space Station, and what the Hubble Space Telescope is teaching us about dwarf galaxies. My guests today in our Bangor studios, Professor Neil Cummins. He teaches physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. He's the author of numerous books, including What If the Earth Had Two Moons? And here in our Portland studio with me is Edward Gleason, an astronomer. He is also manager of the Southworth Planetarium at the University of Southern Maine. As many of you may know, I occasionally am a guest lecturer there, which nominally from time to time makes Ed my boss.
Anyway. In the interest of full disclosure, Erwin is a wonderful employee.
Anyway, welcome to both of you guys.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, of course, we want to hear from you, too. If you're a stargazer, our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Main Calling or post to the Main Calling Facebook page. Now, our ancestors used to view the heavens as something eternal and, for the most part, fixed. We now, of course, know that's not true. The stars in the sky move relative to each other. They evolve during lifetimes, with new ones born and old ones dying all the time. And all of this is leading me back into our solar system to talk about a feature on Jupiter, the Great Red Spot. It was first seen by Galileo with his very first telescope, and that would be, what, some 500 years ago?
Early 17th century.
Yeah. But now comes word that the Great Red Spot is shrinking. Has been shrinking since the 19th century, and the shrinking may be accelerating. Ed Gleason, I'll start with you. What do we know about that?
We know it's been shrinking considerably, and actually since the last couple hundred years. Not quite sure why. They have theories, because it's a very dynamic atmosphere. What's interesting, as you pointed out before, we used to think that the night sky was immutable and all the features in it would remain forever. But we found out the universe is quite dynamic and changing all the time, which makes it more exciting. So they expect the shrinkage of the Great Red Spot to continue. The rate is unknown because the rate has not been constant, but they expect it to continue. There are other layers. It might be losing energy. Every storm loses energy just by its own existence and depletion by expenditure. So, to be honest, we don't know exactly how long it will last. I suspect, if I had to guess, we will still have the Great Red Spot throughout our lifetimes. I think we're talking about perhaps it dissipating over the next century. Again, that is still uncertain.
Hmm. Neil Cummins, does this teach us anything more broadly about understanding atmospheric dynamics?
Well, it shows us what we don't know. But on the third hand, we already know how difficult it is to forecast weather here on Earth. And the Great Red Spot is part of the weather of Jupiter. It's like a typhoon or a hurricane. And similarly, it's heated from below. So it's been around for as long as it has, in part because it gets energy from the planet. And the question of how that energy gets focused, where it is, and whether the source of energy is decreasing, which would suggest would be suggested by the fact that it's getting smaller, that those are absolutely open questions.
Hmm. Now, this also brings me to another feature on the planet Neptune, which was the great dark spot first seen by Voyager 2. Within, I guess, about a couple of decades afterwards, the Hubble Space Telescope could no longer find it, and now there is a newer dark spot forming elsewhere in the planet's atmosphere.
It confounded us. When the Voyager first discovered the great dark spot, there was a presumption that it would last as long as the great red spot, the spot with which we were most familiar. And then when it was viewed by the Hubble Space Telescope, it was gone. Another one is forming. I think that's a characteristic of a dynamic atmosphere, where these formations will come and go. And as Dr. Cummins said, it's a very energetic region, and we have a difficult time forecasting weather here on Earth, let alone in other planets, especially where the atmosphere is even more dynamic and more energetic.
Hmm. Well, let's go ahead and talk about some planets outside of our solar system. I mean, one of the most exciting things that has happened in astronomy over the last 20 years has been the discovery now of exoplanets, as we call them, thousands of them.
Yes.
What are some of the latest findings?
Well, we found the Kepler probe is still looking in the region of Cygnus, and it's found one that we have thousands of potential planetary candidates. And I think one of the most exciting findings for me is more of on a general nature, because as we discussed earlier, about 20 years ago, we really had no idea about exoplanets. They were hypothetical. Then they found the first around a pulsar in 1992, and then around an active star in 95. And then now they're realizing the galaxy might have a proliferation of planets numbering in the billions. And so what it's telling me is nothing specific about a particular planet. What it's telling me is that the universe is far more creative than we once believed, and that our galaxy could host billions of planets. And we're also learning that solar systems are much more varied than we once thought, because when we only knew about our own solar system, it was a neat sock drawer. We had the four planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, as nice terrestrial planets nearby, the gas giants farther away, Pluto was making difficulties. Okay, but it was a nice terrestrial initially toward the sun, gas giants farther away, and there was an assumption that has turned out to be mistaken that other solar systems would have a similar format. Now we found hot Jupiters. We have found so much variety. The universe is far more creative than we've given it credit for, and it's always confounded our assumptions about it.
Yeah, and Neil Cummins, along those same lines, some of the latest discoveries have also included very small gaseous planets and what's being called a mega-Earth. It's like two or three times the size of Earth, 17 times the weight.
Right, and what's really interesting about the planets, the terrestrial Earth-like planets that they're finding, is that some of them, in quotes, some of them are in a region around a star, their star, where the temperature is appropriate for water to be liquid on the surface, and that changes everything. If you expect life as we know it to exist, you have to have liquid water on the surface, and finding planets that are in or near those regions that, as you said, are Earth-like, not exactly the same size, the same mass, but similar, is one of the strongest indicators that we're closing in on the possibility of finding life in the galaxy, in our Milky Way galaxy. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
I might add one thing. It turns out that we've also found multiple planets orbiting some stars, like we have in our solar system, and people can do the statistics on the numbers of planets there are, given how many we've found already. And what's really cool is that it appears there are more planets in our galaxy, which has several hundred billion stars, there are more planets than there are stars.
Hmm. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Just a quick reminder, if you'd like to join in our conversation today, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, or you can email us talk@mpbn.net or tweet at Maine Calling. Neil mentioned just a moment ago looking for life, perhaps elsewhere in our own solar system or perhaps on some of these exoplanets. You know, right at the very beginning of the show, we mentioned SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Edward, you're smiling. What's new on that front?
Well, we haven't found anything yet, nor should we expect to. But okay. I tell you, it goes along quite neatly with the discovery of exoplanets, because the search for extraterrestrial intelligence has been a program that's been on for years. And they have frustrated some people who have this instant gratification issue because they want people to find something right away. We're assuming, again, when we know what's happened to our assumptions in the past, we're assuming any other intelligent race would somehow broadcast itself. We've been broadcasting ourselves through radio for many years. And by the detection of these artificially contrived signals, we would hope to be able to detect life elsewhere. We haven't done it yet. But now that we're finding exoplanets, and as Dr. Cummins said earlier, we're finding some planets that are in habitable zones where water could exist in liquid form, it can hone our search. We can at least say, well, we might want to search around these stars because astronomers have found planets around these stars that could support life. Now, the other issue is a matter of duration. There's been life on this planet for hundreds of millions of years. Only recently, relative in the geological sense, just 2 minutes ago, we started broadcasting ourselves since Marconi and Tesla. And so there could be life elsewhere in the universe. We might not be able to find it because, again, if 2,000 years ago, we had plenty of people on the planet, but they weren't broadcasting themselves through radio. So it's still a long search. They have a lot of worlds to check, a lot of star systems, and a lot of frequencies as well. So I think, to be honest, we're still in the search. We can continue the search. It shouldn't surprise us if we don't find anything for decades to come, because there's a lot to try to find in a large universe and relatively few signals. Even if our galaxy teems with life, which I hope it does, you're dealing with civilizations and even life forms that don't have civilizations.
Well, and I mean, and here's a good example. I mean, if some extraterrestrial civilization had kind of flown by and surveyed this planet about 65 million years ago, they would have found it teeming with dinosaurs.
Exactly.
Which
And so... No radio stations then, but lots of life. But there are other ways to do it as well. If I could just segue for a moment into the telescope, the extremely large telescope that they're building in Chile. They just demolished the top of a mountain, and they're hoping by 2022 to have the world's largest telescope in operation. And this one, according to the people who know about the telescope, will have the resolution power to see a football on the surface of the moon, and will actually be able to image some of the exoplanets around nearby star systems, which is an astounding feat that no current telescope is capable of.
And we should point out that to date, a lot of what we understand about exoplanets, we understand because we are inferring. We are inferring from light from the stars, which gives us an idea of orbital speeds and distances, but we're not actually looking at any of these places just yet.
Rarely ever. I mean, there are a couple of techniques that they employ to find other planets. One of them, the first one that was used, was the wobble technique, because every massive object in the universe actually attracts every other massive object. So, for instance, a planet going around a star will gravitationally perturb that star slightly. Again, and by watching the wobbles, which is essentially in the spectrum of a star, can they detect the planets? Now, for instance, Kepler's using the transit method. When a planet transits a star, the star's brightness diminishes very, very slightly because it's blocking a few of the photons. And so they can notice, they can track the brightness of the planet, and if it shows a periodic dip, the periodicity implying that there's a planet going around it at regular intervals, from that they can infer planets as well. And there are other techniques that they use. But for the most part, again, it's still indirect. I do believe, I can't cite the actual source, that they might have had direct images of a couple of the more distant planets. But for the most part, it is still inference.
Yeah, exactly. And the other things that will perhaps help, too, we mentioned the telescope in Chile. Also, NASA is preparing finally to launch the James Webb Telescope
yes.
in maybe 2018. That will be a much larger telescope than the Hubble, operating primarily in infrared light, correct?
Exactly, as I understand it. And that will be true for the other telescope as well, be visible and near infrared.
All right. You're listening to Maine Calling here on the radio stations of MPBN. Good afternoon to you. Our topic today is space. I'm going to go ahead here and take a quick break. When we do come back, we're starting to get in some of your phoned-in comments and questions, so we'll look forward to hearing from you about that. So do stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Kaplan University, committed to meeting Maine's workforce needs with student-centric higher education solutions. Learn more at kumaine.com. By Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, committed to canning their entire line to protect the beer and the environment. BaxterBrewing.com. And Casella, committed to boosting recycling rates statewide through its One Bin, Zero Sort program. Casella, giving resources new life.
2014 marks the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, in which hundreds of mostly white student volunteers from colleges across the country spent weeks registering African Americans to vote in Mississippi. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Stanley Nelson, the director of a new documentary about Freedom Summer, and Charles Cobb, who helped organize the event. Join us.
That's coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, right after Marketplace, here on MPBN Radio. If you haven't been, you should investigate news.mpbn.net. It's our new news site online, the news you need from MPBN and NPR, with a clean new look and a great mobile experience. It is the online resource. It provides you with in-depth coverage of the most important stories taking place in Maine and beyond from a source you know and trust, your public radio station. Easy to explore, mobile-friendly. news.mpbn.net.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today on the program, the latest news from our solar system and beyond. My guests are Neil Cummins, a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine. He's joining us from our Bangor studio. And here in Portland with me, Edward Gleason, astronomer and manager of the Southworth Planetarium at the University of Southern Maine. We're inviting you to join our conversation. You can call us at 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Now, the last astronaut to walk on the moon, Gene Cernan, was in Portland last month. And one of the things he told me and a few other reporters was that the current U.S. human spaceflight program lacks a worthwhile goal.
As I said a minute, we don't have a space program. So how do you tell those kids they got something to look forward to?
Cernan dismissed NASA's current plans to have astronauts go out, lasso an asteroid beyond lunar orbit for study. Neil Cummins, I guess I'm going to start with you. Would you agree with Cernan's criticism that NASA at the moment lacks a worthwhile goal for human spaceflight?
I think the short answer is yes, although I think I would disagree that it wouldn't be worthwhile to explore our neighborhood and find out what resources are out there that we might conceivably motivate businesses to get involved with so that they could get, for example, extra titanium or beryllium or something that they can't get on Earth, or that they can get it more cheaply in space, so that in principle it could become a commercially viable thing to do, which is explore space.
Hmm. Now, the National Academies came out this month with a report that was commissioned by Congress back in 2010 about NASA's current human spaceflight program. It again sort of repeated that criticism that currently the human spaceflight program does not have the kind of goal it needs. It says the U.S. should set Mars as a horizon destination and then choose a pathway to get there, which could include perhaps visits to asteroids or more landings on the moon, or maybe a Mars orbital mission, all followed ultimately by a human landing on Mars. Gleason, are they on the right track there, do you think?
I think they are. I mean, my personal opinion about this is that we've had a lot more success with robotic emissaries than we had with astronauts. No human has ever ventured farther from Earth's surface in about a quarter of a million miles. And my own personal opinion, as I said before, is human psychology, I think, is the biggest impediment. You have people in a vessel for months or years. I think at this stage of our technology, I think we would benefit much more greatly from having robotic probes go to these other planets, even eventually going to Alpha Centauri. I like the notion of Star Trek, Doctor Who more, but I like the idea of humans going to other worlds. I just think that the logistics would preclude us from doing it quite yet. I think the robotic probes with the Pluto flyby, with the Voyage, with the Viking, we've had so much success sending them to other places in the solar system and actually gleaning a lot of information that if we kept with just the robots to other planets for now, I think that would be the best path with humans going once we overcome all the boundaries that we're going to face having people in vessels for years.
I guess one of the things the National Academy's study said was that it's without having that kind of horizon destination, you're just not going to get very much further. You're not going to succeed in attracting the additional funding or the international partners or anything else that you need. If you're ever going, in other words, if you're going to wait until you have the capacity to go to Mars, they kept saying, you're not going to Mars. At some point, you have to say you're going to go and then develop the capacity. Neil Cummins, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that conceptually that's reasonable, but logistically it's a nightmare. And I'll tell you the most specific nightmare is not getting the astronauts to Mars, not getting the astronauts onto Mars, but it's getting the astronauts back off Mars and back home to Earth, essentially, but getting them back off of Mars, because Mars has a lot more gravity than the moon does. And therefore, whereas we could build landers in the 1960s that could land on our moon and blast off our moon and put people back in orbit, we can't do that yet on Mars. Once that technology, I mean, we can't assemble a rocket on Mars to get people off because there's nobody there to assemble it. So it's got to be shipped there, and it has to work the first time. So that technology is really, I think, the major stumbling block for going to Mars. And if your listeners want to get more of a feeling for some of the other issues, there's a book out there called The Hazards of Space Travel, which is intended for tourists, not like don't go, but what you should know. And you can learn more about these things in that book.
Yes, and I think we know the author, too, who just spoke to us just a moment ago. It's an interesting book. We've talked about it before, Neil, and I agree. It's an interesting read. All right. Let's go ahead to the telephones and start to take some calls. The first one I've got is Larry from Bangor. Larry, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello, Professor Cummins. My ex-physics, quantum mechanics professor, says he's going to get back into my transcript and take away my A if I don't agree with him. His position is that the quiescence of the sun is going to overwhelm the chemistry of the Earth as far as global warming. And, you know, we're writing papers back and forth between one another, but I want to know what you think.
Well, that's an interesting question. It does turn out that the sun does not give off the same amount of energy continuously year in, year out. It has cycles, and that cycle is 11 years for the energy. And right now, this cycle that we're in, its peak energy period, which just passed, was the lowest since about 1920. And that means that there is less energy coming out of the sun, and it will have an effect. But the question, will it have a long-term effect on cooling the planet to compensate for global warming? Short answer is no. It's a cycle that is not predictable in the long term, but in some sense, in the next few decades, the energy emission from the sun is not going to be so much less than it is now that it will have a significant effect on global warming.
All right. Fair enough. Larry, thank you for your question. We appreciate it. If you'd like to join our conversation here, by all means, do so. The number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mpbn.net or post to our Facebook page. All right, let's go to our next caller. This is Dick in Brewer. Dick, good afternoon. Excuse me, you're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Just a comment and two very quick questions. I just want to go on record as saying that as far as extraterrestrial intelligence is concerned, I think they've been here a long time. And so, just for the record. My two questions are, one, what the heck is going on with Betelgeuse or Beetlejuice or whatever, however it's called, up over in Orion? And two, is anybody coming any closer to figuring out why the rate of expansion of the universe is changing?
Well, two great questions. First, before we start, I just want to point out Betelgeuse is the star that you'll see if you look at Orion the Hunter. You've got three stars in the belt, two stars above that mark the shoulders. It would be the one on the left, the upper left-hand star. All right, Edward.
Not currently visible, but wait until late July, early August. Well, we know that Betelgeuse is towards the end of its life, and it's similar to the great California earthquake people are waiting for. They know it's inevitable, but they can't time it. And we know that Betelgeuse will someday go supernova, and when it does, it will be quite spectacular. But we're not quite sure exactly when it will occur. It will happen when they soon, and astronomically put soon in quotation marks, because it could be soon in thousands of years from now. But there's no way for astrophysicists to currently precisely predict when a supernova will occur. So what's happening with Betelgeuse? Well, Betelgeuse is towards the end of its life. It's a red supergiant, millions of times larger by volume than the sun, and we expect it to explode. Nobody knows when it will happen. But again, because it's about 620 light years away, it could have already happened. And Erwin is smiling at me because he wanted to make sure I included that. Again, Betelgeuse could have exploded 400 years ago. We just don't have the light to bring us the information yet. So we know that Betelgeuse is going to die. We just don't know precisely when.
Okay. And what about the other question about the rate of expansion of the universe? Neil Cummins, why don't you tackle that one?
Well, as most of your listeners probably know, the universe, not only is it expanding, but it is expanding faster and faster all the time now. And so the question is, why? Some people, even in the trade, call it an anti-gravity term. Einstein, when he first wrote the equations that described the universe most accurately, had a term in his equations that was an anti-gravity term, called the cosmological constant. And he put it there because at that time, in 1915, the philosophy was that the universe was static. It wasn't expanding. It wasn't contracting. But gravity makes everything contract towards each other. And to compensate, Einstein put that in. When they discovered that the universe is expanding, he took it out again. But now, not only do we know it's expanding because of the Big Bang explosion, but we also know it's accelerating outward. And the question that Dick asked is why? And the short answer is there are a few explanations, but we don't yet have the definitive explanation of why the universe is accelerating outward. Could be that the cosmological constant term has to go back in the equations. There are some other possible explanations too, but quite honestly, don't know.
All right. Fair enough. The number, if you want to reach us, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Buddy in Kennebunk. Buddy, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Good afternoon, Erwin. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm going to draw our attention back to inside the solar system and to our nearest neighbor, the moon. Does the fact that we can never see the dark side of the moon have something to do with the fact that it rotates as well as the Earth?
Neil Cummins, this is right up your alley.
Yeah. First of all, a clarification, Buddy, of definitions. The side of the moon we never see is called the far side. The dark side of the moon is the side of the moon that at any given time is facing away from the sun. And the answer to your question is yes, the moon is spinning on its axis, rotating at exactly the same rate that it's orbiting the Earth, so that we always see the same. It's like if you were to put your hand out in front of you, put your palm facing you, and then spin around. To keep your palm facing you, which is the near side of the moon, if you will, your palm and the moon have to both be spinning at the same rate that either you are spinning or that the moon is orbiting the Earth. So, yes, the moon is rotating at the same rate it orbits the Earth.
And Jonathan, I should point out, Jonathan Woodward, our technical guy, is trying this out next door, and he's getting it. So
they're very
it
impressive.
Works. It really works. Anyway, Buddy, thank you for that question. Appreciate it. Let's see. Let's go ahead and take one more call to Barbara in Lewiston. Barbara, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Earlier this week, I heard on NPR that there are two times in the year when the sun is perfectly aligned with Manhattan. The first was May 15th of this year, and the second is July 11th. And I got the tail end of the report, but it said in effect that either Manhattan is a little east of north or a little north of east, but yeah. In any event, if you face west on July 11th towards the Hudson, you will see the sun perfectly aligned with Manhattan as it sets. Could any of your guests give me a little bit more information on that?
Yeah, I could as a New Yorker, but I think Edward Gleason can too. Go ahead, Ed.
Again, the sun's altitude is always changing, and it's not precise. Its altitude varies throughout the year because the ecliptic, if you imagine the celestial equator, and Irwin being a New Yorker might actually be more specific, the celestial equator is a projection of Earth's equator onto the sky. And the sun is only on that equator two times a year during either equinox, but it's going above in the spring and summer and then below in fall and winter, and then its position will vary. And I
think what's being referred to here too, and the dates line up correctly. Manhattan is pretty much north and south, and it has a very well defined street grid with the cross streets, the numbered streets, running east west. And my guess is that probably on May 11th and 6 months later, which I guess would be November 11th or 12th, right in there, the sun probably can be seen to rise. You know, in the cross streets. If you imagine the tall buildings of Manhattan, like Stonehenge, it would line up just beautifully. Sunlight would come right down.
So it rises due east on the equinoxes, and then north of east and south of east. So at certain times a year, two times a year probably, because it's in the same position, it will line just. It's a wonderful question.
Yes. So, Barbara.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you. All right, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Revision Energy, a local business specializing in the design, installation, and service of solar energy systems. RevisionEnergy.com. And Sweetser, seeking mentors for children with mental and behavioral health needs. Learn more at Sweetser.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama is sending 300 special forces to bolster the Iraq government against Islamic militants. The latest on the Iraq crisis and the security threat it poses to the region and the U.S.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock here on MPBN Radio. Looking ahead to our 1 o'clock public affairs hour today, The Connected World from It's Your World, How the Internet Will Impact Our Future. A panel of experts discusses the Internet of Things and how it will impact the way we live, the way business is done, and how resources are consumed. Coming up ahead at 1 o'clock here on MPBN.
Well, welcome back. I'm Erwin Gratz. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking astronomy. In the studio with me, Edward Gleason, an astronomer and manager of the Southworth Planetarium at USM, joining us from our studios in Bangor, University of Maine, physics and astronomy professor Neil Cummins. Share your thoughts with us about the moon, the stars, interplanetary space travel, or the search for extraterrestrial life. You can give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Now, here's a question that somebody sent us after coming in from their back steps to write down. I think this is in the form of a comment as much as a question, but it says, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence leads me to the question of human assumption that Earthlings would recognize such if encountered. We've been slow to begin to recognize the complex terrestrial intelligence here on planet Earth. We are perplexed by the function of migrating birds or the depth of social organization of elephants or communications between sea life and more. It seems arrogant as we look for mirrors of our own deficient capacity to communicate.
You can't argue with that.
I guess. All right. But anyway, we'd love to have more of your thoughts, comments, so please do keep sending them to us. And we're going to go right back to the phone right now. Next, we're going to talk with Tom. Hold on, Tom. We'll get back to you in a second. I want to go to Claudia first from Augusta. Claudia, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So my question is, I just read a while ago a book called The First Light, and I think it's by Richard Preston, and it was absolutely hilarious. It's the history of the Hale telescope, which at one time was the largest telescope in the world. But it was just, it was informative, it was fun, it turned me on to, like, I got a telescope for my grandchildren, and I was wondering if these guys had a book for a layperson like me that would be just as delightful as that one was.
Okay. Neil Cummins, why don't we turn to you for an answer?
There is a book that just came out, and I have to recall the name of it. I'll get back to you. It's about the combination of telescopes, photography, and spectroscopy that were all developed in the 19th century, and how the three interacted. Spectroscopy is looking at the colors of things. How the three of them interacted and allowed the or demanded the building of bigger and bigger telescopes, such as the Hale telescope, as a great example. And I'll get back to you with the name of it as quickly as I can think of it.
Okay. And if we don't get to it right away, we'll get it to you. We'll post it on our Facebook page and tweet it out there for you.
That'd be great. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to Augusta for our next caller. Good afternoon. Whoops. Yeah, that call just went away. Okay. I'm sorry. I know why that happened. Let's go to Tom in Biddeford. Tom, now it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi, Erwin.
Hi.
And a little shout-out to Edward Gleason, my good friend from Southworth Planetarium.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine, Edward. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Been in lately for some of your interesting programs, but I still enjoy the emails. And
well, thank you.
Your night sky calendar that you send out monthly.
Well, thank you, sir.
I have a Meade 4.5-inch reflector telescope, and it did not come with the alignment instructions that would allow me to align it with true north, I think, or magnetic north, one or the other. And then from there, if I wanted it to search for a particular object in the night sky, I could key it in, and it would go to that setting. Is there any quick and easy way that I could do that myself? Or?
Well, it's been my experience that the best thing to do is to look for the North Celestial Pole marker, which we call Polaris, the North Star.
Mm-hmm.
It's not precisely on the North Celestial Pole. It's within a degree. But I always found if you sight something, when you're using a system that can actually find objects for you, mm-hmm. it first needs to know where it is.
Right.
And so the quick, easy way, I would think, at least to approximate it, is to first use a sighting scope to find Polaris, because that will mark north. And then if you're using software, that makes the matter a little bit more complicated, simply because you'll have to input altitude and other factors. Because, again, the computer is very smart. It has a beautiful database with thousands of objects. But it first needs to know, it's not clairvoyant. It first needs to know exactly where you're putting it and how high.
Right.
So it can exactly know exactly where to align itself, because some of these go-to systems, it can actually move. It knows exactly where it is. It knows exactly the almanacs where things go. So the short answer, which I should have given initially, was to first use the North Star Polaris as through the sighting scope, and that way you can get your bearings.
All right. Great. Thank you, sir, for the call. We appreciate it, as always. I want to go to an email message that came in from Jonathan. Who writes, is Planet X, also known as Nibiru, mythical, or does it really exist? Either of you gentlemen know? Ed?
I'll give this one to Neil.
All right.
To the best of my knowledge, it is entirely mythical. If that is the Planet X, which is on the opposite side of the sun from Earth, that is the one, then the short answer is no, it's not there.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Let's go to Alan in Newburgh. Alan, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question about Mars, and I've seen some photographs or whatever you want to call them, a kind of anomaly of the face on Mars and the five-sided pyramids and whatnot, and I was kind of curious as whether life was on Mars and whether it got stripped off by a super flare from the sun or whatever, and their atmosphere just disappeared along with the water.
Well, I know that there's this famous face on Mars, and to me, it just seems to be a matter of geology rather than deliberate intelligence, because it seems to be the interplay of light and shadow of an eroded mesa, essentially. And so these structures that you see on Mars, again, I realize I'm being a wet blanket about this, but the structures that we see on Mars are more geological. We don't have any evidence that there was any other civilization on Mars at any time that left behind any of its constructs.
Okay, but that's civilization. But there is a bit of an open question as to whether some form of life might have taken hold on Mars.
Yes.
Probably not there now, but we can't be sure about what would have been true in the past. Exactly.
They found more water on Mars than they thought, and evidence of microbial life, because that I think that's really extremely important, because if they do find evidence of life on Mars, which they have found, if they determine that life did exist on Mars, it shows that life can take root in any planet that has any hospitable environment whatsoever.
Yeah. Now, of course, it's believed Mars had a thicker atmosphere but lost it. Do we know whether that's simply due to its smaller size and lesser gravity, or do we not understand completely maybe why the atmosphere of Mars did not persist? Neil Cummins?
The short answer is it is the low gravity on Mars. Each gas has a certain mass, a certain amount of particle content. And the higher the mass of any given particle, the more the gravitational attraction of the planet. Our planet, for example, has enough gravity to hold on oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, argon, a whole variety of gases. Mars, with less gravity than Earth has, does not have enough gravity to hold those gases down. So most of those gases, excuse me, down. So when those gases get heated up, they fly into space, don't come back. And therefore, it is likely that Mars had a much denser atmosphere. It's likely, it's almost certain it had liquid water and a rich carbon dioxide nitrogen atmosphere. Most of that is gone. The water, for example, when it evaporated, much of it flew into space, didn't come back. And that is why Mars has much less atmosphere and no surface water now.
Okay. All right, great. Let's take a couple more questions as we're starting to run a little short on time. Next one is Paul from Auburn. Paul, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes. My question is there a bigger diversity of elements on outer planets and outer stars than there is in Earth? Do they know through spectroscopy?
Okay.
I would say no, because the elements we found, the ones on the periodic table, are the ones that are throughout the universe. There's something called the fundamental theorem of astrophysics. It applies to chemistry as well. There's carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all the other parts of the universe. We wouldn't expect to find any other type of exotic element, because it's a matter of nuclear physics. It's just the way that protons interact. And we are safe in our assumption that the way nuclei gather together here the same way that they do elsewhere in the universe. So the short answer is we would expect to find the same elements elsewhere as we find here, just in different abundances.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Paul, for the question. We appreciate it. Let's go to Stephen in Lincoln. Stephen, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. What a great topic today.
Thank you.
And my question is, with all the wars that are going on here on Earth, all the problems we have, should we actually think that a show like Star Trek, that shows science being done by the Earth coming together, all the countries working together, everybody working together for the common good of science and mankind, is that just science fiction? Or is something like that, looking at the problems we have now, and it seems impossible, is that just science fiction, or could that actually be plausible someday?
Neil Cummins, go ahead.
Well, that's a wonderful question, among many others. I remember back in 1969 when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, and those of you listeners who are old enough, I will bet you a nickel that you all remember exactly where you were, what you were doing when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. And at that time, I would say, I think it's fair to say that virtually everyone on Earth, all the groups that were fighting, the sects that were fighting, they stopped. They listened, they watched, and for a very short time, we were all in it together. So as that is backstory, Stephen, I would say that under the right circumstances, the conflicts that are going on can be considered secondary to greater things. And when that does happen, I do believe that we can all come together and work for a greater purpose to make something succeed or to ensure survival or something as important as that. But I think at this point in our social development as a world, as a group of societies, we're not there yet unless and until something like landing on the moon or the survival of the Earth as a whole comes before us.
All right. We're going to leave that as the last word. Neil, Edward, thank you both for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Erwin,
yes, sir.
The name is Starlight Detectives is the name of the book.
Ah, excellent. All right, there we go. Neil Cummins is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Maine in Orono. He's the author of numerous books, including What If the Earth Had Two Moons? Edward Gleason is an astronomer and manager of the Southworth Planetarium at the University of Southern Maine. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Jonathan Woodward ran the board, and we had additional help from Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio and from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/mainecalling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. Tomorrow on the program, the latest on our understanding of lung cancer. Learn about prevention, treatment options, and support for patients and families. I'm Erwin Gratz. You've been listening to Maine Calling here on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine's public universities. Join the people who are making Maine even smarter and stronger. Learn more at think.maine.edu.